And without further ado, let's get started. Our host for tonight, Zoe Clark, is Michigan Radio's program director. Ann Arbor native and resident political junkie. You may also know her as the co-host with some guy of a little segment we call It's Just Politics, and she'll tell you more about that. Without further ado, Zoe Clark.
Hello. I'm only laughing because Rick and I usually host these together, and about half an hour ago I said, I think I should just host this one by myself and we can keep you as a panelist.
Yeah. And then we had a discussion. Yeah. Welcome to this It's Just Politics edition of Issues and Ails.
Yeah.
Thrills and chills and thrills. Yeah. That we will set up a series of topics for a discussion, and you will get a chance to answer questions. You will get to witness Zoe and I tussling for control of the event, and then you will witness as Zoe wins.
Why don't we
Yeah. So quickly, part of why that is, though, is I want to give this a quick update, which is that Rick was actually spent the day in Flint today speaking with Attorney General Schuette, covering the latest indictments when it comes to the Flint water crisis against now who is the highest level official in Governor Snyder's administration to be charged. So I want to jump into that. But first, I'm really, really, really excited to introduce to Rick's left, not necessarily politically speaking, we have Chris Kolb.
But probably.
And Colleen Perrow. So quickly, Chris Kolb.
Right,
exactly. to my right. Chris Kolb, if you have lived in Ann Arbor, he needs no introduction. Chris was a city council member for many years here in Ann Arbor, ran for Ann Arbor mayor against a Republican mayor because there was actually a mayor who was a Republican in Ann Arbor at one time, if you can believe that. More importantly, Chris served this part of Ann Arbor for 6 years in the State House of Representatives. He held the seat that now Rebecca Warren used to hold, who's now a senator. So Chris Kolb, ladies and gentlemen, who's now the president of the Michigan Environmental Council. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And I'm going to introduce Colleen, who I've known you for so long, I don't know how long I've known you.
In the 70s?
But Colleen is the executive director of the Michigan Republican Party. That is her current job. Before that, she has served as an advisor.
Okay.
As an advisor and counselor to senators and governors, and she's also been very active in advising international journalism groups on how to operate within a democracy, small d, and that's Colleen Perrow.
Yeah. Thank you. Happy to be here.
And I brought a Republican with me.
One Republican that Colleen brought is what she's saying. So this is what's going to happen this evening. I want to get questions to all of you. We would go on and on, which we do. So my hope is to open it up to questions this evening. We have a lot to talk about. Not a slow news day, as we say. Quickly, though, I do want to just start with the big news out of Flint. Rick, quickly give us an update, if you can, in like 30 seconds, because that's the story at length that you filed with NPR today quickly. What do we know out of Flint today?
It takes me that long to clear my throat.
I know. What do we know that happened in Flint today?
Today, the attorney general and the legal team that he's assembled announced that they have charged the director of the State Department of Health and Human Services and the state's chief medical executive, who's also on the U of M faculty, related to the Flint water crisis. And the biggest charge is involuntary manslaughter in the deaths of people who contracted Legionella, Legionnaire's disease. The allegation is that, on the part of Nick Lyon, that basically he knew about the outbreak and he knew about the threat and stayed quiet on it. And Eden Wells is facing a similar charge, but just that she didn't tell authorities when asked when she knew about the threat. But these are the highest level officials who've been charged, and certainly involuntary manslaughter is the most serious charge that's been leveled yet. Also, there are five people who've already been charged with other crimes in this investigation who also now face involuntary manslaughter charges. So this is a big, serious deal.
Chris Kolb, you were on a commission, a panel that Governor Snyder actually appointed after the Flint water crisis, a bipartisan panel, we should say. One of the Democrats, you, on that panel, came out with recommendations.
More you co-chaired than, it with Republican Ken Sigma.
Yeah, more than 40 recommendations about how not to ever let what happened in Flint happen again. That report came out last year. Talk to me about, were you surprised by these charges from the Attorney General today? Do they make sense to you?
Well, I've read what the Attorney General has put on online, and that's about as far as I can go in depth on that. We knew this was an issue. We had questions as to why it wasn't declared a public in a notice. We just opposed what happened in New York City when they had an outbreak, and they immediately went public. There was like five hospitals involved, and we said looking at that and what happened in Michigan was, my word, disturbing that it happened differently. But they had declared in early spring of 2015 the outbreak over. Thus, I don't think there was an announcement at that time. Should there have been before that? I think that becomes a question. It's also, when did the director know of the outbreak, and at what point is he obligated to let the public know? And the reason you do is that then that puts the whole medical community on notice that they should be looking for this, and that someone has pneumonia, you should be checking for Legionella contamination or exposure. We had different, there are multiple ways of how Legionella could have impacted the community. One was, could have been just confined to McLaren, which was what most people thought.
The hospital
in their heating and cooling system. Or because of how they were flushing the lines, it could have been released from the biofilm within the water system, so it could be system-wide. What was apparent is that this was a huge spike in cases, and someone from a public health position, whether the county or the state, should have gone public with it. And that's sort of what we criticized. What we said was there needs to be better coordination and better notification process with that.
I have a question for Colleen, which is... you've operated within Michigan government for a long time. We should point out that also you are an attorney, that we are now seeing a State Department director being charged with a crime for decisions about what to reveal, not reveal, whatnot. What does this do if these charges stick, and maybe even if they don't, what does this do to the state's capacity to recruit people for those kinds of positions? Nick Lyon is a career civil servant.
Well, I think it dampens anyone's desire to go into public service. Why would you want to go to a department and be in charge of something if something happened down the line? And I don't know all the details. I only sat in a couple of your meetings. But to see a person who, like Nick, is a fine public servant, he served on both Republican and Democratic administrations. To see this happen to him, I just think it's going to be more and more difficult to pull people into public service.
Rick, what is this, and I want the panel's a sense of this, what does this do for Rick Snyder? He is now sort of a lame duck governor, and that, you know, he is term limited. He still has 18 months, though, left. What does this do for his ability to govern?
I think it strikes at two particular commodities that are exercised by a governor. And one of them is that ephemeral commodity called political capital. And that when you are under attack and your popularity and your competence are being challenged for any reason, it becomes that much harder to get the legislature and the public to get behind controversial policies. And he's still got a few that he's trying to get adopted in the last 18 months. And the other commodity, and it's actually two, and they are time and attention. And the question is, how much of this administration's time and attention are now going to be devoted to dealing with these serious criminal allegations that are leveled against cabinet members, as opposed to other stuff that they could be doing with the same period of time. And Colleen, you've worked in the front office. I mean, what do you think?
Well, it's going to be difficult, but of course, they've spent a lot of time on Flint already. Yeah. It's been front and center for, what, the last 2.5 years. I will say, though, that Flint is so much more complicated than many of us know. I was deputy director in the Department of Civil Rights until about 4 months ago, and the Civil Rights Commission actually held hearings in Flint as well on the water crisis. And if it had been a different population, shall we say, would people have come in quicker to see what was happening, to explore further?
The report said if this were Birmingham.
Yeah, if it was Birmingham, or Ann Arbor, for that matter, or East Grand Rapids. We felt that it would have happened differently because you would have had someone who was out there front and center coming to the government and saying, hey, what's going on here? So it's a complicated situation in Flint. Again, Chris did much more of the science side of things than we did, but it's something that has plagued this administration for the last 2 years.
It's just something here I'll just add. I mean, it is our recommendations. One of them was to address environmental justice and the policies and training of state employees and how we make decisions here. The governor has appointed an environmental justice work group, which I co-chair, and we're moving forward on that. But it was, you know, part of our recommendations, and then a major portion of the Department of Civil Rights recommendations. The environmental justice is an issue that we as a state need to really address and come to terms with and have a way to move forward on that.
What does it say to you guys that it seems to be, it might not be a universal consensus, but there is at least a bipartisan cohort that acknowledges that environmental justice is an issue in Michigan. Would you have thought that would have been, that we would have seen that kind of an acknowledgement even 8 years ago?
I would say not 8 years ago. I think maybe a couple decades ago, yeah, we could have had that if it had been really a real codified sort of issue. But I think it does say something that you hate to see that you have to have a tragedy like Flint to have issues move forward. But we are learning some lessons from that and moving forward as a state, hopefully. And I've seen the departments and employees in it really start to figure out how can we deal with this. Angela Ayers in the governor's office went down to Detroit and actually, you know, met with a couple members of the work group just to hear from them, you know, what it's like to live in parts of Detroit that have huge hot spots when you're looking at whether it's air, you know, pollution, water, land, whatever, the really big hot spots, and figure out what it's like to live there on a daily basis. And I give her some credit for doing that because she didn't have to. She could stay in Lansing in the governor's office. I think that, you know, out of Flint, it's going to take all of us to keep these issues moving forward, but we can make progress. And I'm just glad that we're coming together on some of the issues and moving them forward, yeah, here in Michigan.
And I think on the regulatory side, you see a lot of employees actually holding hearings. They used to just hold them between 8 and 5. So who could come to them? Not many people. So now they hold them in the evening. They hold them on Saturday. They hold them in a township hall or an old school building instead of downtown in City Hall. And I think they're getting to a lot more people and are getting feedback from so many people when you're having hearings on licensing or any regulatory system that affects a particular population region.
I just want to add one thing. One, yep, thing we'll have to see, though, and I agree, we had a great presentation just yesterday on that, but is it changing the decision-making within the state and within the departments? And that's what we're going to have to really show. We can change all the public input, but if it does not change the decision-making, yeah, then we have failed. And that's going to be my next question to them is, how have you changed your decision-making through this process? And that's what we hope to do.
It's a start.
Yeah.
To get the end.
So I want to open it up to questions, but very quickly, because we don't host It's Just Policy, we host It's Just Politics. I want to talk.
It's Just Policy is like two doors down.
Two doors down. It's on the main stage because it's Ann Arbor.
Main, so let's go down.
I do want to quickly jump into, though, reading a little bit behind the statements from Attorney General Bill Schuette and Governor Rick Snyder, two Republicans. Rick Snyder says that he is actually going to keep Nick Lyon and he's going to keep Eden Wells as part of his administration, that he believes that they are innocent until proven guilty, that that's how the American judicial system works. But there is no love lost between this Republican governor and the Republican attorney general. Chris, you are smiling. Oh, I'm getting to Colleen, too. You're just the warm-up.
And we should point out that in his statement today, he took aim at the attorney general's handling of this case and how long it has taken other members of the administration that have already been charged to be brought to trial. He basically accused them of dragging this out.
And he also did not call him the attorney general at one point. He just called him Bill Schuette in the statement. So anyway, Chris, really quickly.
And he said that his employees would be on duty. So that's a shot at Bill Schuette on duty.
Exactly. So, but I do, again, I want to get into the policy, but you can't not talk about the politics here. So, Chris, what was the takeaway from this? Just a little bit of pokes and some jabs between these two?
There were some blows, you know, being traded back and forth. Obviously, there is no love lost between the attorney general's office and the governor's office. If you want to look at blatant politics, the attorney general, though he's not a declared candidate, is running for governor. And the lieutenant governor, you know, Brian Kelly, is running, you know, for governor. That would be
neither
an extension.
Of them are declared. They're not declared. Everybody knows it.
But everyone knows. I mean, and so that would be extension. That's a Snyder 2.0 administration. So, it's extension. The governor is obviously, you know, in that camp, in my opinion. And this is my own interpretation. But they're going at it. Last week on Mackinac Island, Brian Kelly drops a part-time legislature ballot initiative we'll talk about. You know, this week it's Bill Schuette's week, and they're going at it. But there is, we all know in Lansing, there's no love lost between those two offices, the governor's office and the attorney general's office. And it's, you know, it's internal to Republican, you know, sort of politics. And so I'll let Colleen, but we all see it and we all understand it.
I pass.
No.
I plead the fifth.
No. Colleen, no. My old friend.
I'm going to have Tony Darazinski. Yeah, he's my lawyer here, and he tells me. He says, pass.
Get your money up front.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. So pleading executive privilege, much to like Jeff Sessions from a few days ago. Yeah. No. But Colleen, I mean, look, you and you don't have to jump into all of the politics, but I think we can at least talk about in front of this crowd that there is not pure Republican hegemony in
unanimity.
Lansing right now. That, you know, yes,
no, there is hegemony. There's not unanimity.
Yes, thank you. That there's Republicans in both the House and the Senate. And so it's easy for folks who read that and go, you know what, Republicans control the show. This is how they're able to get everything done. But the fact is, it's not one voting block, and there are disagreements.
You're right. And I remember back when Jim Blanchard was governor and the Democrats held the Senate and the House. And when you hold everything, a lot, you know, the differences within a party come out. When you have divided government, then the differences between the parties come out. But right now, the Republican Party, we have a lot of people that believe in a number of different things. They have different issues upon which they base their leadership, et cetera. And so, yes, okay, I admit. There does appear to be a rift between the governor and the attorney general. But I shan't go further.
There does appear to be.
Okay, so let's open it up to questions, because we've been talking for way too long. So Miss Lindsay Scullin is walking down the aisle, and she's just going to pick a lucky person. And if you would just say your first name and how about where you're from, just so we know who you are.
Hello, my name is Gia, and
hi,
I
Gia.
Actually am from Flint.
Oh, nice. Did you just come in tonight?
No, I moved here a few years ago, but like that's where I grew up.
Yeah,
that's where
yeah.
I was raised.
Sure.
So I guess my question about the whole thing is, how do you all feel like unconscious bias plays into a lot of these issues, you know, regarding environmental justice in Flint, and even regarding like gun laws and gun control in response to the tragedy that happened earlier today in Metro DC and in healthcare and things like that. Why does it always, you know, some people say like, why does it take a catastrophe like Flint? Why does it take a tragedy like Sandy Hook? Why does it take a tragedy like this in order for something to be done about it? But it seems to me that a lot of times that pause or delay in things happening is because the people that are affected don't look like the people who are in power and making decisions and legislation. And so as long as you feel safe and like it's not going to happen to you and you don't recognize the humanity in the other people that it is affecting in general, then you're fine with what's going on and you're not taking action to actually kind of change things.
Yeah, and I want Chris, you to jump in about environmental racism quickly, but I do want to say that I think Colleen pointed out that the fact was that the department report did come out and say, you know what?
The Civil Rights Department
report.
Colt Commission
that said
report.
Race did play a role in that.
Historical. Yeah. I mean, this is, as you know, you're from Flint. It's very complicated, and it goes all the way back to the formation of Flint and the covenants that were held in the neighborhoods, the ordinances, who could buy land where. If you were of color or if you were of Southern European lineage, you would only be able to buy in like a two-block area, for example. Everyone else could buy someplace else. And it went on and on. A lot of this is historical. It's based on history. And So I don't think we as, me as one of the drafters of the Civil Rights Commission's report, said anyone now consciously or even subconsciously was involved in any racist thoughts or anything, but historically the system seemed to be set up so that certain people could only live in certain places, would not have the same representation, and that is going on, that's been going on. So that's what, on that side of things. We can go back to the Washington thing if you want, the Virginia thing at a later time, but Chris.
You know, race played a big part of it, but so did the politics of the emergency manager law. And the vote had occurred, and then the legislature, you know, jammed it through again.
The referendum repealed it, and then the legislature and the governor adopted a new law.
A new law, and so a lot of, I'm not going to point to any individual, but I my take on it is that a lot of Republicans saw what was happening at Flint through that political lens. The people who were upset about the emergency manager law were using the Flint situation to fight that battle all over again. I think, you know, race played a part of it. I think politics. Flint is a Democratic community. They didn't have a good connection politically into the governor's office, which is, you know, Republican. If it had, you know, and I think you could reverse that. And if you had a Democratic administration and you had a real Republican area, you might have the same sort of disconnect. Unfortunately.
Which also has an income element to it
as
well.
Yes, and income. There's a lot there. But
at the same time, the Flint citizens weren't able to get through to Flint elected officials. I know there was
who
a,
had no power,
emergent,
and the emergency manager
though,
has
even,
no
but they
there,
still
absolute
weren't
control.
Dingwalling had moral authority.
And they haven't been
they
able
have,
to get through with it.
No, but they've had, I mean, the emergency manager law, what's really the most distressing part of the emergency manager law is that they have absolute control. The only check on them is the Treasury Department that has to okay any contract over $50,000. Otherwise, there is no place for public input. When the political decision-making apparatus stops listening to its constituents and addressing their concerns, nothing good is going to happen. And that's what we actually found, is that you have to have a process for citizen input, whether it is through an ombudsman's process, an appeal process, letting the elected officials have some sort of you know, role in decision making in these financial, these stressed communities, something has to change. And that was actually my quote in the press release, is that when you don't, when you stop listening to your constituents, bad things happen.
I'm just saying that even pre-emergency manager, I agree, the emergency manager situation in the state of Michigan is crazy because there is no input. And once the emergency manager leaves, then everything just goes back to the way it was. But the problem that people have experienced in Flint more than just the last decade is that even prior to that, historically, the citizenry has not always been able to get through to their represented officials in the city.
So have we come anywhere close to trying to then fix that problem?
That I will tell you that that is one big gaping hole in addressing the recommendations of both, I think, the Civil Rights Department and the Flint Task Force, is that that is a statute that needs to be addressed, and no one seems to be moving forward on it.
Hey,
no,
well,
here,
can
I will
jump in.
Go ahead.
Colleen,
go ahead.
Why do you think that the administration and the legislative leadership have all said that they're willing to listen to ideas, but they have certainly not been proactive in saying we're looking to change the emergency manager law to fix the problems that led to what happened in Flint?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure what's happening there. I think what they've been focusing on right now is getting a budget. As you know, and have been around the Capitol for a long time, you don't just, okay, this happened in Flint, so for the next 2 years, we're going to focus on that. There has been a lot of attention paid to Flint. Things that have come into fruition that have helped the citizens, some things that haven't come forward yet, the emergency manager law. But there are a lot of other issues going on. So I'm not sure why this isn't front and center right now. I don't know if the other side is pushing something front and center, or are they also worried about many of the other things that we have to be worried about in the state, whether it be our infrastructure, our water, or anything else.
And it's worth noting that as a practical matter, that the administration really is backing away from using the emergency manager law as a tool to deal with local governments and school districts, but especially local governments.
Okay, let's open it up to some other questions.
We could go on. We could have fun.
I'm Tony Darzinski, and I'm from the past, actually.
That's where I met you.
I think it was way back.
It's where I met you.
Yeah. Oh gosh, a long time ago. And I'd like to bring something up from a long time ago, and that is a comparable situation, which we all of a certain age went through, which is polybrominated biphenyls.
PBBs.
The PBB cans. Mm-hmm. That was a scary, scary health issue for the state of Michigan. And it's very interesting, and I'd like your reaction to that, how that was handled by Governor Milliken facing an election in 78 where he had a challenger who happened to be a state senator named Bill Fitzgerald. But it was an issue that it was potentially very upsetting because you had a major health issue. People were claiming all sorts of bad things were happening because of a fire retardant that was placed in food for animals. And it was handled, though, it seemed to me it was handled, looking back at it, very quickly and fully. And the science was not clear, and it wasn't clear whether or not or how serious the scandal really was. Nonetheless,
there was kind of a distinction there. And one of the people who was advising the Governor Snyder on dealing with Flint was someone who advised, and I know that you know this, who advised Governor Milliken on PBB. And one of the things that they did, and we are talking about real politics here, is that there was a perception that Bill Fitzgerald had just pushed the PBB issue too far, and so that Bill Milliken was basically able to kind of jujitsu this and say, look, I've been doing the people's business on this, and they acted quickly. They formed commissions, people got fired, and that made a big difference in terms of how Bill Milliken's, how he dealt with the PBB crisis was perceived versus the Snyder administration's handling of the Flint water crisis,
where they denied it for a long time.
I think that's what's going to come out here in terms of any trial is going to be the process.
Right, and of course in 1978 you had a half hour of news a night. Right? And you
that
didn't,
is huge.
You didn't have the internet, you didn't have everything we have now. Yeah. It's 24/7 on steroids.
Yeah.
When you add in the internet, social media, everything else, you actually had time to put together a commission, to put out a press release. You can't do any of that now. I mean, the time is so limited.
But it didn't take 2 years to continue to let people drink brown water in that case. No. I mean, it was a much quicker response. And that is the other lesson from Flint. If you're getting brown water that long out of your system, something's wrong, and we need to take it. It's not a joke. I mean, you need to take these things seriously. Water is something that we all need to survive on, and we need to make sure that our regulations are treating it as a health issue versus an engineering issue, meaning that if you're putting this into your body, it needs a higher level of scrutiny than we are currently giving it.
Okay. Great. Lindsay, yeah.
Hi, I'm Lee from Ann Arbor.
Hello, Lee.
Talking about Bill Schuette earlier, I think he's been running for governor for quite a few years now. And I just wanted your opinion on what are the advantages he has and what are the disadvantages he has.
Colleen, you've worked on political campaigns.
Well, I mean, Bill has a long history in public service. He has been in the, so he knows what it is to serve. He was in Congress. He ran for Senate, lost, was an ag director, did a really fine job, actually, as ag director. Started the big food bank program that's statewide now. He then went on to, Court of Appeals, where he served for 6 years, did a good job there, and decided, actually, while he was on the Court of Appeals, because as a judge, you just get to take the law and you get to apply it to the facts, but you can't say, I don't like that law. Oh, I forgot he was in the Senate for a while, too.
Yeah.
But skipped
State
over that.
Senate.
State Senate. And so he decided to run for office and ran for AG. I have to say that I did work for Bill as a special assistant attorney general. I worked in the area of human trafficking, school violence, the Enbridge pipeline, and opioid task force. I think he's done a lot of great things over there. Yes, he's been running for a long time, but most people that run for office these days in the era of term limits, you put your eye on something and you run for it a long time. You can only be AG now for 8 years. You can't, you know, Frank, there will never be another Frank Kelly or Richard Austin.
Chris, so those
So I think his experience is something that is an advantage. And experience, of course, can be a disadvantage because he has all the votes. He has the opinions he's written. He has the Flint. He has all kinds of things like that. But the experience is a two-edged sword.
Yeah. Chris, so those were some pros. Are there cons?
I think I will admit, Bill and I talk on the phone, and he allows me to call him Bill, and I still call him Mr. Attorney General. But... You know, I think that he does have experience. I think the cons are he's taken some positions that are going to be hard to defend in this era. But he also has a good, so there's another pro.
You're talking about gay marriage.
I'm talking about lots of different issues. He's challenged every Obama administration's, you know, executive order. I mean,
people
virtually every single one.
People aren't going to remember the environmental stuff the same way they're going to remember that.
No, I'm just, hey, but let's, he is good at seeing an issue and grabbing onto it. So there's no doubt in my mind why Bill Schuette. I believe he does care about the Great Lakes, but I think he's seen some really good polling issues, polling numbers that say being against Line 5 is good and the Asian carp, you know, issue is good. I don't have a problem with that. I think Bill doesn't ever really try, what I like about Bill, he doesn't really try to be anything than what he is. And he's a public servant, he's a politician, and he's running for office. I have no problem with that. Some of his issues, I do have a problem with. On the whole transgender bathroom issue, we had a private conversation on that, and I will just say publicly that I offered to come in at any time he would like to to do some, you know, to give him my opinion on the issue and do that privately, because I think all public servants should come to decisions based on knowledge and understanding of issue. If they still want to end up on a side of that I disagree with, I don't have a problem with that as long as they do it based on a really informed decision. And his position was that it was a government overreach, that the executive branch was overreaching, and thus it had to be shut down. And I think there
and
will be issues
with
that.
In his role as Attorney General, that's what he's supposed
to
do.
But the short answer is Colleen's answer, which is that his strengths are his weaknesses, which is that he has been a politician for a long time and that he has a record, but he also is a master of messaging and the pivot when necessary.
I think I want to add one thing, and then we'll open it up to questions again, though. And
more
that, questions. And that is 2018, which is something that we have no idea, particularly in this political environment right now, what 2018 is going to look like. What we do know, historically speaking, though, is that the party in the White House, so that would be Republicans, tend to not do well in the first midterms after a presidential election.
That's only since Roosevelt, though.
Or excuse me, only since Roosevelt's time. So what we know in the recent past.
So, wait, which Roosevelt?
You know, so, you know, if you're looking historically, you know, one of the cons could be, depending on how the next, you know, year and a half looks, is where is the nation politically in 2018? Of course, Obama came in 2008 after a huge landslide of Democrats in 2006, taking back the House. He wins the presidency, the Democrats do in 2008. And then 2010 was an all-out disaster. And since Obama became president, over 1,000 seats nationwide, both in state legislatures and federal seats, have been lost for the Democrats. So, I mean, I think you could talk about Schuette as a microcosm, just as himself as a candidate.
Well,
but don't you think
question.
Some of it is going to have to do with politics nationally in 2018?
Will state issues matter in 2018, or is every election just a referendum?
No, state issues will matter. They will matter. I'm sorry? Okay, yeah, I think state issues will matter. But it depends at the national level how great the issue could be. I mean, I worked in the state house. What is it? Saturday is the anniversary of the Watergate break-in. So I worked in the state house and when we lost a lot of seats as Republicans. Had nothing to do with state issues then. I think everything is so different now, though. Everything is so localized, and I don't know. We'll see what happens. If something
tragic happens.
It just
seems like the last even year elections that we've seen over several cycles have been referendums on the national mood and judging what's happening in the White House and in Congress.
Okay. Where did Lindsay go? Oh, there you are. Okay.
Thank you. I'm Connie Cook, and Zoe had a good segue about the loss of Democratic seats across the country. Do you know where things stand right now regarding the prospective ballot initiative on redistricting? I know there's an effort to have collaborative decision-making about constitutional language.
It's a hug.
Where do things stand?
For another drink.
No. Yeah. Actually, we're full disclosure, Colleen sits on the Board of State Canvassers, which that is still an open question before.
No, this ballot initiative has not come before the Board of State Canvassers yet. It's out there. I'm not sure
because
what
it keeps getting withdrawn.
What?
Because it keeps getting withdrawn.
No, that's the part-time legislature.
Part-time legislature.
No, this is the
Colleen, doesn't it have to do with the fact that as much as Democrats and progressives and liberals really, really desperately want to end so-called gerrymandering and redistricting, that no one in Michigan is willing to put up the $10 to $15 million that it's going to take to actually get this ballot proposal on the ballot in front of voters?
Is because it only creates about a half dozen more competitive districts, and it's going to take more than that if one party or the other is going to seize control.
But if there was a progressive who said, you know what, I'm going to write a check right now for $10, $15 million to Byram Fisk or whoever, and let's get this going. Let's go $1 per signature. Let's do it.
I think Mark Brewer is on this, though.
Yeah,
he's crowdfunding it.
But isn't it just a monetary issue?
FEC claim?
Yeah. I mean, Chris?
I was avoiding the whole Mark Brewer situation.
Well, let me tell you about the Mark Brewer situation.
I think you don't have to.
How many people even know who Mark Brewer is in this tent? Okay. So let's do a quick little refresher.
How many people know about the $500,000 FEC fine that was levied last week? The largest fine in FEC history against any political party. Yeah, that was last week.
But
over
was
the weird issue of political bingos.
He was he's also Gretchen Whitmer's lawyer. Oh, I think she may have fired him last week.
So the basics behind this are, it's been something that, like I said, progressives and liberals will talk about, and I think really, really do want to get it done. But in this day and age, getting a ballot question on the ballot isn't just a bunch of, you know, neighbors going, we want to change something, let's go stand outside at the summer festival and get signatures. When you see the tree alcohol or marijuana-like alcohol ballots, that's not like a couple guys in their dorm over in Ann Arbor who are signing it. These are giant, statewide, big money behind ballots, and the fact is, like
because
I said,
to get on
someone
the ballot
isn't,
in Michigan, it you takes, cannot do it without paying petition circulators unless you are Right to Life of Michigan, which has a constantly honed battalion of people who are ready to go out and collect signatures, and they're well trained, and the petitions are clean. Everyone else, if they want to get on the ballot, at least for some of them, you've got to pay professionals.
So there's two things. One, the ballot initiative, it is very difficult to get on the ballot. But also, the petition that people are talking about, none of us on the board have ever seen the
It doesn't
language.
Exist yet.
But it is not a panacea either for redistricting. If you look at California, they have an independent redistricting commission. How many people in here think you can have any kind of commission that is completely nonpartisan? Impossible, right? So they have one there, though, and one of the big things that people object to here is they say, well, we have oddly shaped districts. If you saw the oddly shaped districts in California, you wouldn't believe it, and they were all from this independent commission. It looks like biology, Chris knows, but the amoebas sort of splitting in two. I'm sorry? There is, and that we use here. We have the APOL standards that have been upheld as a model across the country.
We sort of use the APOL standards.
We do use the APOL
standards. We have a lot of leeway in how we draw districts, obviously, here in the state of Michigan. I mean, here's the thing. I think Zoe's right. It's going to take a lot of money, and from a progressive standpoint, there's always seems when it comes to good government proposals, there's always a better fight to fight. And in this case, you got to make sure if you're bringing it to the ballot, it's going to drive your voters to the ballot. So you want to make sure on any sort of ballot initiative, if this is a sort of progressive versus conservative, which I'm not sure this is, but you want to make sure that it drives the right voters to the ballot. And you've got to have 10 to 15 plus million dollars in the bank and more to come if you need it to get it passed. So, I mean, that is really why I don't know if it's even going to get to the ballot. That we've seen a lot of good ideas never get to the ballot because of that.
And
those
another,
two issues.
Another thing on the oddly shaped district, this is the only way we can comply with the Voting Rights Act to make sure that we have proper minority representation. So you have the APOL standards, you have the Voting Rights Act. Those things are put together, and that's how we come up with the districts.
And the argument in Michigan for the shape of a lot of the current districts is that it followed migration patterns of minority populations as they left the city of Detroit into mostly Oakland and Western Wayne. That was actually an argument.
I didn't hear that argument.
All right, next question.
Okay, Lindsay.
Bob LeBrant made it.
Well, quick statement about the last thing. Somebody wrote a computer algorithm that would fairly draw districts. There's an article on NPR about it. It's pretty good. And then a question orthogonal to a couple of the stuff you guys have been talking about, how to recruit people for public service, career politicians, and how to get people's input. Is there anybody that's working on how to actually try and bring younger people into politics? It seems like there's a lot of roadblocks, whether it be like job, education, that kind of stuff, that that we're kind of like leaving out a whole segment of the population who might have really good ideas.
1, 2, 3, Colleen, go.
Yes, we are trying to bring people into the party and younger people, and we have people across the state who are reaching out to college campuses, also high schools around the state, bringing people in. We have Duke, how many interns now? 10 in our office. We'll have another 10, 15 in a couple more months. Really trying to get people involved in politics. When I was in high school, I had a government teacher, and he said, everyone should get involved in a party. Now, I was from Newaygo County, so there was only one party. So, but get involved in a party and stick with it, because the only way the parties change is if the people stick with them and change the parties. And so we are reaching out every day, trying to get more people, young people, old people, everyone coming into the party who share our ideas.
What about nonpartisan civil servants?
What about nonpartisan civil servants?
Young nonpartisan civil servants.
To
recruit them. Is it just the parties, or what about the state as a whole?
I don't know. I don't work for the state.
I mean,
anymore.
Well, I guess I'm wondering.
We started when I was in the House in 1974. We started an internship program, the first internship program at Michigan State, pulling people over both parties, having them work in the legislature. It was a great program. People still do that. When John Engler was governor, he started a governor's internship program. And you could come in and they would pick 20 people from around the state. They'd be positioned in state government. State government, though, is sort of shrinking. So to recruit a lot of young people is difficult. I will say in the House and the Senate, they do a very fine job on both sides of the aisle pulling in new people.
I think, yeah, I mean, this, the government has been, we are shrinking it beyond shrinking it, so it's becoming not just small government, but cheap government. We have to compete with the private sector on salaries and benefits, and in many cases, those are being changed on the public side as well. In the news, all you hear about the public sector is that it's bad. Government is the problem. I mean, we've heard that for now 3 decades or more. So it sinks in. So why would you go in versus, I mean, then you take the Flint indictments all the way down where they had, you know, low-level employees all the way up now who have been been charged criminally. Why would I want to go into it? So we've built a lot of hurdles. Now as an entity, we need to start knocking those hurdles down and really going out and recruiting not just young people but qualified people and coming up with plans to bring them in. One of the hardest areas we have in recruiting is in the sciences. And it's important because there are so much public policy and human health issues that are driven by science that we need to figure out how we can get good information and good science into the public sector. And it's one thing that Dennis Muchmore on his way out, and I agreed on.
The governor's chief of staff.
Former chief of staff, was that there is this problem and we're losing, you know, as employees retire and we don't have the funds to really replace them. We're losing really good knowledge, and we need to address it. In elected office, my God, you know, the best place to start is at the local level. Get involved. Where government really works, decision-making, is at the local level. The state level, when I was there, wasn't that bad either, but you need to be involved. And if young people want to have their issues and their voices listened to, you got to vote. You can't just be passionate about an issue. You have to vote. Politicians pay attention to people that vote, and you need to be engaged not just on an issue, but you got to go there every election and vote, and that then the system will pay attention to you.
So I want to quickly get to another question, but let's talk about, because you kind of offered the absolute opportunity to bring it up, which is, you know, downsizing government and this idea about turning Michigan into a part-time legislature. Rick, why don't you quickly give us an update of where things stand right now, the history behind it, and then let's talk about whether this is something that Michigan could actually see.
Although we should point out that the decline in government employment seems to have bottomed out, and that we are actually seeing a slight increase now after a very, very, you know, long trend, that the part-time legislature petition is they are still collecting signatures that they're trying to get on the ballot. Brian Calley is leading it, making it ostensibly a case of, you know, him versus the establishment. There is no one credible who doesn't believe that this is a precursor to his campaign for governor. in what's expected to be a fierce mano-a-mano campaign for the Republican nomination for Bill Schuette. Although we should point out, when we thought that this was going to be the case in the last open Republican nomination, it was a campaign between Pete Hoekstra and Attorney General Mike Cox. And you remember who won that one?
One Rick Snyder.
Yeah, it wasn't one of those guys. So, you know, that's all out there. But that petition campaign is still out there. We will see what happens. They don't have final approval, and that's what I was alluding to before, from the Board of State Canvassers, upon which Colleen serves, an advisory opinion that this...
Who is the advisory opinion
from? From the Board, an advisory vote that this actually meets the...
From the Attorney General's office,
Well, the Attorney General's office has an issue on that and said that the line...
No, the Elections Bureau has a division, has an issue on.
Hey, listen, I've served on this board for 5 years. You're wrong. So,
I know the Attorney General's office has an opinion on the language.
The Attorney General's office represents every branch or every department of state government. Civil Rights Commission, they have an Attorney General sitting in on every meeting. The Board of Canvassers has an Attorney General sit on every
meeting. Has an Assistant Attorney General who's basically embedded with the department.
Yeah, and they have to be because no one within the department, even if you're a lawyer, can represent the state of Michigan in court unless you are an Assistant Attorney General. Those are the rules. So the Board of Canvassers, things come before us, the board. There are four of us, two are...
Can I interrupt you? Do you know what we're talking about when we talk about the Board of State Canvassers in this process?
Everyone.
Okay. Very, 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 very quickly. There is a state elections board, two Republicans, two Democrats, and they perform a bunch of functions. The most important one is that they certify the results of elections. One of the things that they do as a courtesy to ballot campaigns, because it's in everyone's interest to avoid legal fights later on, is they will decide whether or not a petition, the physical petition, the piece of paper, meets all of the technical requirements, that the paper is the right size, that the font is the right size and it's in the right places, that it does all the stuff that the Constitution says, the state Constitution says a petition ought to do. There is a petition, the petition for a part-time legislature has been on and off of the agenda of the Board of State Canvassers for a couple of months now.
No, 1 month.
1 month. Okay, for then 4 weeks now. And
4 weeks. Okay, got it.
So, and the most recent iteration of this, after it was rolled out by Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly, was that there may be an issue as to whether or not it meets the constitutional requirement that it fully explains all of the parts of the Michigan Constitution and state law that it would change, what it would insert into it, and what it would delete, what it would
alter or abrogate.
Yeah. And so that's where this controversy is coming in. And the big picture is it's become this argument about, I'm really trying not to hit you. I'm sorry. I keep waving my arm.
Do you understand yet? Okay.
So that is the controversy, and it's being...
So two meetings ago, it was brought before us, it was on the agenda, and it was pulled just before the agenda. Now, people say, that's because of just capitalization issues. But it said the language has changed that was capitalized. So it made a big deal if the wrong language was capitalized, because you would think that was new language. That was wrong. So they pulled it. We had another meeting scheduled for last week. Was it last
Wednesday?
Week?
Wednesday.
Yes. And it was pulled again. It was not pulled by the Attorney General's office.
Well, I didn't say it was.
And the Attorney General, who usually gives us our primary Attorney General, was actually in Pittsburgh.
And when she says Attorney General, she means Assistant Attorney General.
Right.
The staff attorney who's assigned to the department.
So I understand that they felt there may be a problem with the alteration or abrogation issue, so they pulled it again. The attorney for the petitioner
withdrew it again. It was the only thing on our agenda other than a de minimis contract change on voting machines, so we canceled the meeting. We now have a meeting scheduled for next Wednesday at 11 a.m.
Oh.
Yeah, breaking news.
I was going to say, who's going to tweet that?
But it will be on the agenda.
But let's quickly, and we can do a masterclass session after this, if we want, about why this matters. But let's very quickly talk about the fun little politics behind it, which is why reporters got their panties in a bundle, including this one here and this one here, was because it was the AG's office, Bill Schuette, and it was Brian Kelly, the lieutenant governor, who is, you know, pushing for this proposal.
Nothing
and,
to see.
And we all wanted to jump up and wave the flags and say this was Bill Schuette interfering with Brian Kelly trying to get a part-time
It would have been a lot of fun to label this
ballot.
As just
and,
another...
And had the facts correlated with that,
it would have been a delicious
story.
Okay.
It's still Brian Kelly's story, though.
Well, and Brian Kelly will continue to push
it. But he's wrong on this.
Yeah. Okay. Lindsay.
Hello, yes. I'm Victor from Jackson,
Hi,
Michigan.
Victor from Jackson.
Hello. Off on a different area, I'm wondering how concerned the state officials and organizations are with respect to our voting process and the possibility of other outside interests digging around in there. You know, is this being seriously addressed in the state? And by the way, were we one of the states where allegedly they got in?
I don't believe so. No, we have a very decentralized system, which is why you have to wait until the next morning, 10, 11, 12 o'clock, to find out how the state voted. In our system, in many states, everyone has their voting machines plugged right into the internet. As soon as votes are tallied, they go up to the Secretary of State's office. Here in all 83 of our counties, our voting systems are not attached to the internet. So they download, they tally them there, and many times it's so arduous. They type them out and they sometimes fax them up to the Secretary of State's office. So, no. I'm sorry?
Yeah, Michigan, we do.
Yeah. There is a paper trail, yeah.
Michigan. Actually, having followed the brief recount process, one of the things I noticed, and I'm sure... Briefish. Uh-huh. Was that
Jill Stein had a chance in Michigan. What are you talking
about? Was the bigger
about?
Problem...
She was right up there.
She was robbed.
Wasn't
was
that
robbed.
There wasn't a paper trail, but actually how we store the paper trail. And that's the thing that we really seem to need to fix.
But also, I think the answer is yes, we need to be concerned, but we need about everyone has to be concerned. In Michigan, we do have, we're one of the states that has a paper trail. States that have no paper trail are asking to have a problem. I mean, whether they do or not, they're asking for it. I will go back to the other area that we need to be really concerned about as a state is, do we have good IT services? And recruiting that or having a good contract with an outside provider is something that's going to be very important to protect that issue. And that's just making sure that when we vote, our vote is counted and it's accurate, and that's it. I think that most of us all agree with that.
And the good news is that the Board of Canvassers, this is the Board of Canvassers show, by the way, voted on 3 new voting machines, and they will be in place this next year. Every one of the counties in the state of Michigan, all 83, will get the machines. And because of the market conditions that we had, we're the only state that's voting on this or that's buying machines this year, it won't cost the locals any money. So everyone will be getting new voting machines. They've been tested at every step of the way, and they should be at a voting booth near you.
And they're not being built in Russia.
Any of you will see them in mayoral?
Yes.
Yes, they're all paper.
And you'll see them in mayoral and city council elections this year.
Yep. Okay. Yeah, Lindsay.
Hi, Rick from Ann Arbor. Last week there was some news about allowing concealed weapons without licenses to be carried in the state of Michigan. I thought I was listening in Texas, but I guess this was Michigan. Can you speak a little bit about this? And is this real, or is there anything we should be concerned about, please?
Do you want to give the breakdown?
I guess that's me. Yes, it's real. That there is a bill moving through the legislature. I don't. Well, it passed the state house. It has been sent to Senate Government Operations Committee, which means that the majority leader is exerting direct control over it. And while he is generally on the more expansive interpretation of Second Amendment rights, this is not one that's widely viewed as a winner for Republicans in many respects, and it does not seem to be on a fast track.
Chris, you look like you're...
That was basically what I was going to say. I mean, when the House says it's a fabric tax and that... You
coat
have to
tax.
Get a coat tax, fabric, doesn't matter, same thing. That... Because you have to do a registration fee to get your concealed weapons license. That's how they presented it on the floor of the House. It got voted out, you know, very quickly there. Law enforcement's against it for the most part, and thus when it gets to the Senate, I mean, the Senate usually is, in most cases, the more logical, deliberative chamber. It's narrowing these days, but it usually is. So the majority leader, you know, rightfully put it into his committee.
You were only in
the House. I was only in the House. I can say that. Listen, I'm a House member. I'm never on time. I'm, you know, doing a million other things than what I should be doing. But in the, and we take a hell of a long time to vote. But the majority leader, you know, put it into the committee, that the Government Ops Committee, and that's usually a committee where things go to die or they have extreme control over its fate.
Well, what that means in terms of the culture of the legislature and the state Senate is that this is an issue that's not being put to the majority caucus to manage, that the majority leader is taking personal management of it. Does that make sense?
So it's sounding like you're going, not going to happen. Okay.
I wouldn't go that far.
We're done.
Okay. No, in the back.
Hi, my name is Michelle. I've been in Ann Arbor almost 4 years now. I'm originally from Montreal, Canada.
Welcome.
I'm going to go directly another route completely. But we're talking about the political systems here. And there's a lot of things I love about American politics. But there's the one thing I've always had a hard time understanding is there's only two parties, Republican or they never are out there. For example, in Canada, we have 5 parties represented in Parliament. In Quebec, we have 4 parties represented there. Is there a way to encourage people to maybe who are interested in other visions that are not the Democrat or Republican? Is there a way that these parties could someday get more out there and then maybe have more young people interested because they don't see themselves in 2 of the old parties?
Well, a third party candidate did win Michigan on March 8th. His name was Bernie Sanders. So you're starting to see some of that.
Actually, Michigan was one of just half a dozen states that voted with Teddy Roosevelt in 1912 when he was the Bull Moose Party candidate.
Yeah, so, yeah.
I mean, it's not unprecedented.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there's a couple different reasons that we can talk about from, you know, intro to Gov Civics 101, which is we don't have a parliamentary democracy. So that's one reason why we've continued to have a two-party system. The other is the idea of co-opting ideas, right? So that either an independent party or a small group says, you know what, this would be a really good idea. And one of the bigger parties says, you know what, we think that would be a really good idea. And you voters should come and vote for us
One of the natural characteristics of the two-party system, and we've always been a two-party system pretty much in the United States, even though it hasn't always been the same two parties, you know, Whigs and Federalists. You know. But as a practical matter, what seems to have happened is that when an independent party movement occurs, there are a couple of characteristics. One is that it's generally associated with a personality, that there's someone who's really pushing it. And the other one is that any ideas that are associated with that personality that aren't already part of one party or the other party's agenda are co-opted by one or both of them. And so it's not that third parties and independent movements don't have an influence, but the influence is on the two major parties.
There also is a mathematical problem that in a winner-take-all election, there's only going to be two parties. And as you said, it may not be the same two. This is mathematical because you have to win to keep your supporters engaged at some point. So when it's a winner-take-all, you really mathematically are going to have two parties, but a new party can rise up, win enough, and then take the second place which happened with the Whigs. They disappeared. But that is how it happens.
They're coming back, man.
And it's all
actually
mathematics. That was
even before Franklin Roosevelt.
So Europe and other places are proportional representation. So if you win a certain amount of the vote, you get a seat in Parliament. Thus, you win something. And thus, it's easier to keep together as a party and moving forward. Here, with winner take all, if you don't win at some point, you're going to disappear.
And I'd be interested in Colleen's international perspective on this. Is another thing is, Americans like winners. That one of the things...
Everyone likes winners.
Well, one of the things that we've noticed in American elections is that when it seems like someone is going to win or one side is going to win, that then attracts support, you know, as opposed to, you know, sort of this, you know, a minority insurgency.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, one thing I'd like to bring up, I don't see any questions on the floor, but, you have a question? Go ahead. Well, I was thinking back because I was looking at Tony, and I was thinking back to when I was first involved in this, and we would have disagreements in the House. We'd have disagreements in the Senate and even in the governor's office between the parties. And it was never as vitriolic as it is today. And people say, well, it's Trump. It's not Trump. I mean, we see so much of this now. It used to be that staff members would argue vociferously, I mean, tooth and nail on an issue, and then go down to Dagwood's and have a beer. No more. It is
you
very
did not travel
difficult.
As far as Dagwood's in East Lansing.
I would.
There's Kelly's downtown.
But it's very sad. It's something, frankly, that the young man who said, what are we doing to get people involved in politics? I think it's something that turns people off. And I think the internet is one of it. I had a group of six German journalists here today. And one of the things that we talked about, what has really changed politics in Michigan? Term limits, social media. I forgot the last one, but those are two big ones. But that is something that is just so horrendous. And to see this and to think that people across our state think that Republicans and Democrats can't talk at all. Last night we had an event in Washington, D.C., and the young man who was shot in the chest at the baseball practice this morning was a former...
You mean the young man from Michigan?
A young man from Michigan. Used to work in the House of Representatives here. Then he worked for Dave Camp. Then he worked... Now he works for as a lobbyist there. And I thought it was great the way the House and the Senate... Or the House Republican and Democratic leadership came together on that. Because we are not going to solve all the issues facing this state or this country if we keep going from that corner to that corner. Sometime we have to meet in the middle. And that is something that to me is so terrible and so depressing about what's happened. And I'm not going to blame these two people here.
Maybe a little.
Maybe a little. But there are people who, night after night, I don't care what system, what station you're listening to, but they keep stirring this up. It's these people versus these people. They're not talking about issues either, by
Amen.
The way.
Amen.
So I just bring that up and hope that we can get past it.
But well,
it,
can I? I mean, I can't, you can't blame it on the press. I mean, you really can't blame it.
I'm not blaming it on the press, but I am saying that they exacerbate it.
You know, but it takes the institution to have a process that brings people together. You talked about staffers. The staffers are now very young and very inexperienced, almost as inexperienced as their legislators.
Almost.
It takes legislators
some
to...
Some know.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, listen, I've seen the change since I've been up there. I will tell you, it takes someone to proactively step across the aisle. I was at as many bill signings with Governor Engler in the 2 years I served under him as I was with Jennifer Granholm in 4 years. Why? Because I took the first step and went over and found someone I could work with. That's not being mentored
right.
in our systems
I agree.
Anymore.
And that's why I have you talk to my international
Yes,
folks.
And but it takes individuals, but it also takes the institution itself and those who care about the institution to form a process to make it happen. Because right now, there isn't anyone, and it's spinning out of control. And the other big change is that too much power is being given up to leadership, and the committee system isn't working like it did. Tony would be, you'd be aghast at what goes on in committee today, and it's a lot worse than it was.
Explain what you mean by that.
It means that it used to be that when you were the committee chair and you're in the majority, that you had real control over what moved and didn't move through your committee, and the real power, the body could take that bill out of you.
That you were the manager of that area of policy that came before the State House, because you're talking about the State House.
Yes.
Okay.
And State Senate was the same way, that they can, that the chairs controlled, you know, and they knew a lot, and they decided what. It was good in some cases and bad in others, because good ideas got trampled on for a long time. But he doesn't, today, you're seeing bills come into committee, they're gone the next day. There isn't a real, you know, an amendments approach. They're not really debating the bill. It's just going. And that, it doesn't matter who's controlling. This is not a Dem or Republican issue. This is an institutional issue. And we're not getting the type of laws that we really should be getting in this state. And that's because they're not putting the time in to understand the issue, to really deliberate over it, and reach across the aisle to figure out how it can be done better. I was lucky. I had committee chairs who worked with me. And so I was able to get stuff done because they were willing to listen to what I was saying. If you don't have that, then I believe the process breaks down and we get really shortchanged on the legislation and the statutes that are being put into place than we really should. And so we should demand for a more deliberative process in Lansing.
And we have time for about two more questions, but and I do want to just do a little serious note for a second, which is, you know, we're joking about the media right now and what it means to be constantly watching either Fox News or MSNBC. But I can tell you that as the program director at Michigan Radio, which I hope that many of you listen to, and maybe is some of the reasons why you're here tonight. And no. Yeah. Stop long it. Time listener, first time caller, 888-258. No, but that is that I oversee the entire news department at Michigan Radio. That includes the programming department, that includes hosts, that includes news reporters. If you could have seen my phone this morning, starting from reporters who just wanted to know where they needed to be and the stories that they needed to tell, whether it was because of Flint, whether it was because of the shooting in D.C., these are reporters whose lives revolve around bringing you stories, and maybe you heard during the last fun drive the hashtag Facts Matter. That was a Michigan Radio logo and idea because that's literally how we think about things. So I think there is a cacophony of noise right now and a lot of smoke about, you know, Trump and the Flint water crisis. I hope, though, that one of the things that Michigan Radio is doing, though, is continuing to keep fact-based news. And yes, Rick and I spend 5 minutes once a week talking about sort of the fun and talking about how politicians talk about politics in Michigan.
Not just the fun, but we do talk about the game of politics because that matters in how policies
get
adopted.
And there is a place for that still, I think, and that dialogue. And I think you folks are our reason that you're here tonight because you still believe that's important. So I just, you know, joking about the media aside, yes, but I think there are still organizations like Michigan Radio, like NPR, like the BBC that are making sure that the mission continues to be, which is fact-based.
And now if you want to watch Zoe roll her eyes, lift up your sunglasses, please. I often say, and it's not the only job like this, but it's a difficult job to do well. It's an impossible job to do perfectly. You know, we try very hard to do it well.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
This would not be the first or the last time that you've rolled your eyes at me.
Not to you.
ideas of new urbanism seem to be predominant these days. It's recognized that there are benefits to people moving into denser areas. The number one complaint, as I understand it, for people who have made that move is noise. And 40 years ago, there was a lot of regulation against noise. But as I understand it, it was gutted during the Reagan administration. And I'm wondering, is it just... It used to be a police officer could pull over someone over if their muffler was broken, but that apparently was gutted, and now someone can go through an urban residential area at 3 a.m. and make as much noise as they want, and have no penal penalty.
I think the city ordinance here, I'm sure, precludes
Most cities and communities have the ability to pass their own laws, and so in Ann Arbor we have a noise ordinance, and you can make a complaint, and the police, if they have enough staffing, will come out and check the decibel, how loud it is at the property line, and if it is a problem, they will go talk. The car, they can stop anyone who's operating a car that's not functioning properly, not having a muffler would be one of those cases. I think that where it comes into play is that there are other higher priorities, and they don't have the staffing to address all of those other complaints they would like to and be able to, but they just don't right now.
Okay. Another quick question.
Hi, I'm Linda from Brighton.
Hey, Linda.
Going back to that problem of the two-party system and the tensions and rivalry between us versus them, as if it's some football game that shouldn't matter that much, but it seems to. We've got that sports mantra. And I think a lot of the problem would be is if our leaders would use phrases that we haven't heard since the 60s, a phrase called the common good. I'm voting for this because it's the best for the most people. It's not going to make me happy. It's not going to make my sponsors so happy. But I talk to the people at the bottom that are directly affected by this. And they think this would be good. And experts and data shows that this would be good for everybody. And if you don't do that, that's when you get the peasants with their pitchforks. So that's what I wish. Also, our representatives have to leave town Thursday afternoon, and they don't get back till Tuesday because they need to go get money at these private fundraisers. And so they're basically errand boys of who gives them the money. In the old days, when LBJ was a congressman, there was a rooming house, and they all kind of stayed there, and he'd pretend to shave all day long so he could lobby people. And
so was that better?
Well, at least they talked to each other and socialized with each other because their families are way far away. That's important. Both sides need to have more activities like tomorrow's congressional baseball game where you play together. It would be better if it wasn't sports involved, but just hanging out and feeding each other. And they're kind of in that box where they're in their own little bubble. And so we need to break down the bubble and talk to everybody.
I don't think you're going to have a disagreement. I mean, one of the things that, you know, I'm not to toot my own horn, but we used to try to organize small dinners of having two different, you know, from people from both sides bring together to talk about an issue. And those things happen. They don't make news. It's just not enough of it has happened. And D.C. has polarized long before Lansing, but Lansing is on that same path. And I do fear for it. But you know what? There was a time when people settled their disputes by dueling with each other. So, we think it's bad,
on the Senate floor.
But there have been a lot worse times.
One big duel, and no one ever forgets
it. What's a duel between friends? Is that what you're saying?
And if you never go home on the weekends, they would not be real.
That's a really great point. So one last question here in the corner, and then we're going to wrap this baby up.
I think I want to just back up about 5 or 6 minutes to the very brief comment that the current president didn't start this hostility. And I think that's true. It seems like it's been a normalization of hostility and division for a long time. But I also want to name that the current president is normalizing even more a level of hostility and infighting and basic rudeness and we can all disrespect.
I don't agree with that.
I know, and I, with all due respect, Colleen, with all due respect, I think that that office demands a level of professionalism, empathy, kindness, inclusion, and respect. And I'm Lisa from Ann Arbor, and I'm Zoe's mom.
Yes, indeed. So, and if you were anyone else in this tent, I would have said, and your question is, but because we only have about 30 seconds left and I can hear the band playing behind us, I'm not going to call you out, but I will after we're done.
which we will.
Well, so, I will say that go ahead, I agree yeah. that the discourse is becoming so crude. Mm-hmm. And I again, I don't think he started it. Maybe he's normalized it. I don't know about Senator, what's her name, Gildenbrand.
Kristen Gillibrand, who didn't do anything else to make Democrats seem like they're any more willing to.
If she's passionate about it, she should drop the F-bomb as a U.S. senator four or five times a speech. And she's continued to do.
But
what does that mean? What does that teach?
No,
I'm sorry, but when my kids, when they were in middle school and they'd use that, I would say, okay, let's talk about vocabulary and increasing yours. So,
I would only say that words matter, behavior matters. Yeah. I mean, and we hope that it would, you know, there is an improvement there. But I will get to the top. We haven't really talked about Trump. He tapped into a real anger and fear that was out there. And it, you know, it's shame on us for not really hearing that and allowing him to be the person that channeled that. Someone else could have channeled, we being a Democratic Party, that's what I'm going to say here, putting on my Dem hat. We could have listened, heard, empathized, and taken advantage of that. We missed it. He tapped into it. Whether he's the right leader to do that, I mean, I don't know.
We could spend the next 4 hours on
it. I just think I agree that words matter. Leaders need to recognize their behavior does matter.
We could spend the next 4 hours on equal time, but.
And yet, let's talk about the fact that we all just talked about politics with beverages for the past 90 minutes, and, you know, everyone was very kind to each other and talked respectively. And that is just the most NPR thing ever, right? So I do, quickly before we wrap up, we mentioned it very quickly, but Mike Bishop, John Molinar, and Jack Bergman were at this sort of horrific shooting this afternoon, and there is a Michigan gentleman who used to work
for the State House of Representatives.
For a state rep who also worked for Congressman Wahlberg, Mr. Mika, who works for Tyson now.
Micah.
Oh, I'm sorry, I thought it was... We got to change our pronouncers on air. But I want to just say his family's on the way to D.C. this evening, and so we're
and
all wishing them very well.
Okay.
Yeah, out of surgery. So, okay, everyone, thank you so much.
All right, thank you all for coming out again. Lots more of the Summer Festival going on. You can hear the live bands that's going to be starting. We have another Issues and Ale coming up in July. We're going to be in Detroit, in Midtown Detroit, doing a special Issues and Ale on the 50th anniversary of the Detroit riots from 1967. Hopefully you'll be able to join us there, and you'll find more information at Michigan Radio in the coming weeks. Thank you. Good night.